Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the conference call on Indian Budget 2017, Implications for International Business. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal the operator by pressing star then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Rajesh Samhan. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Hi, and welcome to everyone for this webinar on the budget. To those people who are joining in from the East Coast in the U.S., and also for those who are from the Asian region. The Indian budget obviously was presented yesterday. Or day before yesterday, and there have been a lot of significant sort of changes. There was a lot of anticipation around the budget that had come through. Even prior to the budget, you had demonetization, you've had elections in the US, you've had Brexit in the UK. So it's under this context that the budget was sort of presented, we were sort of expecting many changes. There had been many representations and discussions that had happened over the last few months in terms of, especially for foreign investors who are looking at specific key areas of concerns that would be that they wanted to be addressed. But before we sort of delve into the details, I would call upon Nishit to probably give a few words before we actually delve into the minute details of the budget.
Hi, good morning to everybody in India. Good evening to the people on the West Coast of the Western Hemisphere. And good afternoon to people on the Eastern Hemisphere side. I think this budget, let me put it this way, is a good budget, gives good direction, but it also creates what I call a circular and somewhat unwinding or unending roadmap to many of the things that we are thinking. So on the face of it, the budget looks very good. At a micro level, it is good. But when you begin to get in nitty-gritty, there are several issues, and one needs to be very careful. The other important thing that I saw in the overall budget is there is been some delegation, I would say excessive delegation of administrative powers at a very junior level. And my concern is how responsibly that would be handled. This is a little candid comment. I think in a country like India, we have seen a lot of tax terrorism that became a special, but that is a major concern. Apart from that, we have added wide-ranging new complications. I'm all in favor of plugging the loopholes, number one. Don't get me wrong. But the way in which it is being done, there is increased complexity. And there are simpler ways to administer. For example, we are adding new rules to capital gains tax, right? In the world, to explain capital gains regime, that has become so complex, from India it's very difficult. You know, global investors have very little attention span, and there are a number of geographies to address, and a lot of changes which the finance ministry himself pointed out with reference to the U.S. Situation and the Brexit, and other things that are happening. So the concern is that we have to wade our way through all these complexities, and now we have to really compete in the globalized world that is moving towards some kind of reverse globalization. So when U.S. is going to attract, there are two things happening, as I say, in the U.S. One is, of course, Mr. Trump is trying to say America first. Okay. Obviously, they will do everything to see that investment flows go back to the U.S. They are going to reduce tax rates, just as we have done. They are going to increase interest rates. Okay? So investment flows will move back. Brexit that is happening, again, UK has already taken steps to reduce corporate income tax, maybe even below 25%, maybe 20 or 22% or something like that. How much? 21%. Thank you, Nishchal. And, you know, you are seeing all countries, on the one hand, they talk of no harmful tax competition. But each one of these countries are engaged now in tax competition by reducing tax rates, by offering different incentives, and so on and so forth. Okay. So we have to be mindful of the fact that the world is moving in a slightly different direction than what we thought 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I would also think that in India we have, at a macro level, given a big push to a number of different things. The difficulty is not at macro level, it's at micro level. For example, for startup, there are, you know, we had a big bang last year, 16th of January, our Prime Minister had done a lot of things. And it is, I think, Mrs. Nirmala Srinivasan, she said that we have done everything that startup industry wanted, but I think there are a lot of gaps still. And therefore, the startup has still a problem. So it is important to see that you look at the entire ecosystem and address every problem and streamline. So what happened when, what I'm told and I read in the newspapers, that startup ecosystem went down by 67%, whereas we did Big Bang. So I do not know whether the numbers are correct or not, but at least this was a news report 2 weeks ago. So we have to do a lot of those things. And I would not go too long at this point in time, but there have been several regulatory changes. For example, the FIPB abolition is a great step, number one. Corporate income tax reduction, you know, is a great step. But look at the implications. What has happened if you have a company, they say 25% is a tax rate, and in addition to that, there will be dividend distribution tax, let's say it's about 20%. After that, when dividends are taxed, in the hands of the company, and when shareholders receive dividends in excess of 10 lakhs, another tax. So effectively, you have almost 33% tax on the balance of 25%. Effective tax rate is what? 48-49%. So that is what is, you know, again, we still get back to the higher bracket in the on a global basis. So when, you know, so these are some of the things that we need to be mindful of. Similarly, indirect transfer, I think, good move. Some of the additional things have happened, and but still there are a lot of wrinkles which Rajesh will deal with. Then, also, with regard to the fund, which is the biggest source of investment in India, the major concern for all the foreign funds is whether we will have a place of what is called permanent establishment in India. That is the biggest, right? So, government has tried to give some kind of a relief. But what has happened, the conditions which are put in, last year this thing came in, but the conditions that have been put in, they are applicable to broad-based one and not all broad-based. So, 98% or 95% of the funds have not been able to take advantage of this benefit. So it remains a paper relief. You know, so most important thing is for private equity or venture capital funds that are located abroad, we want fund managers to come to India, be in India, create their activity and stuff like that. And that is where the concern is that, you know, to them there is no relief on permanent establishment, and the hanging sword goes on, and people have to work through different structures and all those kind of things. So that is another kind of interesting thing about, next thing at a local level to some extent, affordable housing has been given some relief, so that is what is admirable. General anti-avoidance is there now, you can't wish it away. new thing that has happened is in relation to thin capitalization rules. So typical approach is for foreign investors or related parties is to put more debt in the company and have less equity because the interest on the debt is deductible and all those kind of things. And now, there have been some new rules that have come in. Again, Rajesh will be dealing in more detail. But, you know, there is a maximum 30% deduction is available. And that's one of the things that, again, in detail, we'll be discussing. Also, there have been changes in relation to capital gains on transfer of unlisted shares. And otherwise, one of the problems, as I said, one major problem that is on the trend I see in this budget is to give more powers at a very junior level. That is one concern, that how it will unfold itself. But second thing is there is a tendency to create multiple taxes that are not adjustable or offsetable against one another. One I mentioned about, you know, equalization levy for the, you know, which is neither income tax nor the GST. So it is not creditable, effective. I would not go into detail, but my panel and others will deal with that later on. If you take potential levy, what is called equalization levy and GST and other things combined, it could go as high as 36%. Because GST can go potentially up to 28%, and 8% equalization levy on online advertising, cloud, etc., etc. Now, almost 40% of startup budget is spent on online advertising. Forget about cloud and other services that will come later on. So, if you see what happens is that 100 rupees are raised by a company, 40 are spent on online advertising, of on with 36% is potential threat of tax, you know. So, if I'm planning my startup, you know, my investment goes in paying taxes before the any income is earned, right? And these are some of the issues which will be discussed in the course of today's presentation. And also, as I was mentioning, so this is not offsetable. So this is multiple. There could be income tax, there could be GST, and there could be service tax, and there could be equalization levy. In relation, I was talking about capital gains. Now, the way in which our system is working, when somebody, I'm not going to explain in detail at this point in time, but if you pay some money to somebody, you are taxed, and if you receive money, then also you are taxed. So same transaction is twice taxed. So I see constant tendency to create double taxation on the same transaction. And that is what will be explained to you later on how it unfolds itself, you know. So I think this is not a great way because, you know, you're creating multiple level of taxes and complications and the cost of doing business in India increasing. Again, other thing is about the transfer pricing and secondary adjustment concept. The concept for secondary adjustment has been introduced and we'll discuss in later. The POEM, you know, rules are going to come. Personally, I think it's not a great idea. POEM is a very old, antiquated, maybe 200-year-old concept. And India, when it introduced income tax almost first time, they moved away from POEM concept. And incorporation was taken as a primary criteria, which is a more modern concept. Of course, central control and management, which is slightly different from POEM, was in existence in the UK. So only a foreign company was fully controlled and managed, then to become tax residents of India. But primary criteria was incorporation. Now, this incorporation is a more modern concept. So U.S. has only incorporation as a criteria, not place of effective management or not the central control management. And it is a cleaner, easier. In last about close to 80, 90, 100 years, there has been hardly any litigation, two or three cases on residency, corporate residency. Now with POEM, we'll see a plethora of litigation. That is another fear. We could have gone to continue with the same criteria, but only thing, in order to protect revenue interest, better criteria would have been to introduce CFC regulations. So, you know, unnecessarily the foreign income doesn't escape taxation, but there is a lot more clarity in CFC regulations, and those are the kind of things. And finally, I must stop. I've gone too long. Sorry for thinking, because there are so many amendments, so I had to make some pointer to each one of these items. But over to you, Rajesh and Mayappan, and Nishil, thank you for joining this morning. And
Thanks, Nishil. I think while there were many sort of themes that you had picked up, and let me sort of try and now get it to the issue that...
My job is to wake up people, right?
Sure. I think let me sort of get it into, I think, the theme that we're sort of talking about double taxation, multiple layers of taxation sort of coming through. And it's really in this context that the amendments to the indirect transfer provisions sort of become important or critical. And again, as a backdrop, I think by now everyone has known about the fact that the government had introduced provisions relating to taxation of sale of shares of foreign company by one foreign company to another, which is essentially what people mostly still call it the Vodafone tax. But there have been concerns that have been expressed over many years now. In April 2016, the government actually specific rules as to when the tax would actually apply. But there were still a lot of lingering concerns. Mansi, coming back to you around some of the changes around indirect transfer, especially in the context of the circular that was issued last month, then further deferred, and they tried to address some of the concerns in the budget. But to you to sort of explain around some of the concerns and how the government has tried to address it.
Sure, absolutely. Hello, everyone. So I think, as Rajesh was mentioning, this has been, since the Vodafone controversy, we've been grappling with the issue of this Vodafone tax or the indirect transfer tax. Over the last 4 to 5 years, what was originally drafted, which was, of course, retrospective, it has seen, you know, updates every year. And now I think we're, from where we started, we're definitely in a better position because at least the thresholds for fixing the tax are objective in that sense. You have a 50% death, etc. But where the current law actually lacks is in terms of genuine exceptions being carved out of cases where the indirect transfer tax should not be applicable. And that was sort of the representations which we have been making, the clients have been making to the government time and again. And the hope really this year had been that now the budget would show some of these relevant exceptions. But to everybody's surprise, remember, to some of these concerns, the government went ahead and issued a circular in a Q&A form. And that is what caused a lot of confusion among the foreign investors and the foreign funds, because essentially the circular disregarded the fact the way the current law is drafted, it leads to multiple levels of taxation. Essentially, that you may, the actual transfer or sale may have been taxable in India. In spite of that, when you distribute proceeds up the chain to the investors, to the intermediate holding companies, there could be additional tax under these indirect transfer provisions. So they ignored that problem and then took a very technical interpretation of the law. Of course, the reaction was extremely bad. Government was receptive, and 2 weeks down the line, 2 to 3 weeks, sometime in January, the circular and abeyance, which we thought was good news because it meant that they were going to consider the issue. The budget, what that proposes, so it's a mix, somewhat of a mixed bag. It is, the change is definitely positive, but all that was promised in the budget speech hasn't been delivered in the fine print. So what I mean by that is, the finance minister said that they would clarify for Category 1 and Category 2 foreign portfolio investors, and that has found its place in the change. So investors that are holding directly or indirectly any asset or interest in an FPI investor, so in a fund that is licensed as a Category 1 or 2 FPI, they will be exempt or excluded from the applicability of these provisions. So that is very positive. However, the finance minister in his budget has also clearly stated that they would be issuing a clarification with respect to the fact that in case of redemptions of shares and interests outside India, which are as a result of sales of direct investments and have been chargeable to tax in India, they will also be able to be excluded from the indirect transfer provision. However, we have not, this hasn't made its way in the fine print. So I think to that extent, there is still ambiguity. We will be waiting for further clarification on this, and that will be extremely crucial because currently they have only gone halfway, only excluded some of the FPI investors, and we still have categories. FPIs and the PE and the VC funds, which have this ambiguity lurking.
Sure. So I think purely in terms of the clarification, what the government has essentially said is two things. One is that if you're a Category 1 FPI, which is a sovereign fund, or a Category 2 FPI, which are essentially broad-based funds, those particular entities will be completely, or investors in those entities, whether directly or indirectly, will be completely exempt from the indirect transfer provision. So that, at least as far as capital markets today are concerned, because this was in the last month and a half, this has been a huge issue, especially from a capital markets perspective, because with most of these funds, investors may, they're all open-ended, investors may come, investors may go at any point in time. So having indirect transfer provisions was not really workable as far as they were concerned. So that's an exemption which has come through. For the broader category of other investors, whether it's private equity investors, whether it's corporate investors into India, if there are any transfers which are happening at any layer in the chain, at this point in time, potentially even that is still within the indirect transfer net. The carve-out which the government intends or has said that they will provide is in terms of any upstreaming post-Indian sale, so which is something that we have to wait and watch. So to a certain extent, again, I think the key at this point in time for everyone is to see what is the nature and what is the form in which the clarification would really come out, to see whether that's going to still leave open issues around for some of these investors. I think the second set of changes, which was really, again, something which has been discussed for quite a few years, was really in terms of conversion of preference shares into equity shares, especially in the private equity or venture capital industry. Most of the investments which are being made into India, or a large chunk of them at least, you end up making investments through convertible shares, and the idea being that especially because the conversion may be linked to certain parameters, because on day one, let's say there is a valuation mismatch, so you have convertible, you have terms set out, or even in terms of liquidation preference. For all of that, you try and ensure that traditionally you always had convertible structures in place. The issue that has always been there is that when do I convert? If I convert into equity shares, is it taxable? Is it not taxable? What is the cost of acquisition or the basis in the stock? What is the period of holding if I convert? How does it get computed? All of this, there's always traditionally been a lot of ambiguity around it. I think one of the changes which the budget has done is to provide some clarifications around this. Umansi, back to you in terms of, again, some of the changes that sort of came through on this.
Sure. So as you were mentioning, because of the way the law is currently drafted, there is some amount of ambiguity as to when do you trigger a tax event. Is it on conversion? And of course, it's on sale, but whether the conversion itself would be taxable or not. Depending on what view one takes over there, it also impacts whether when you're finally selling the shares, does that tag your period of holding and whether you get a step up on basis, etc. So there was a lot of, ambiguity created here, as opposed to, for example, in contrast to compulsory convertible debentures, where the law was far clearer. It was simply not a taxable transaction when you were converting a CCD into equity shares, and you could tag the period. However, the cost of acquisition, which is important when you're calculating the gain, went back to the original cost of the CCD. Now, essentially, the change that this budget is proposing is in line with CCDs. In other words, when you convert a CCPS, that will not be seen as a taxable transfer. And when you finally sell the shares that were acquired pursuant to the conversion, the cost of acquisition would go back to the original CCPS, and the period of holding would also include the holding period of the CCPS. So while in terms of the proposal that the budget has laid down, it's in that sense positive, because of course the clarity in this regard is welcome. There were contradictory judgments and positions that people were taking, so in that sense it's positive. However, as Rajesh was mentioning, CCPS have historically been used by VC investors and early stage investors, and a lot of them may have invested through Mauritius and Singapore, where you're looking at the treaty, where all investments prior to 31st March have been grandfathered. So a lot of times, I mean, we've been grappling with, for the last year or so, with, you know, questions regarding what is the right time to convert. And, you know, if you were to convert after 31st March, the shares that you actually acquired are not, supposedly not grandfathered with the way the treaty reads. However, if you convert them prior to 31st March 2017, the shares that you acquire would actually be grandfathered, considering that this may not be a taxable transfer, and you in any case go back to the cost of acquisition. It definitely raises questions as to what the strategy should be, and perhaps it makes more sense to convert in some cases prior to April 2017. So I think essentially, Rajesh, the changes that have been proposed are raising those questions, and I think investors will need to give that another thought now that they've given this clarity in law.
Sure. And for the next couple of months, I think that's the question which most investors are going to end up having, whether to convert or not to convert.
If I interrupt just for a moment, one good thing that has happened this time is that the budget has been pronounced on 1st of February. So you've got 2 months' time to plan. If this would have been traditional on 28th of Feb, you would have very little time, 1 month. So in a sense, this is also a blessing in disguise, you know, whether to convert, not to convert, whatever decision you want to make. Now, it's a good sign, because people need to roadmap, forward.
Sure. So that's at least, I think for at least for the next 2 months, a lot of people will be planning their affairs. I think the one other sector which really had been hit by demonetization, and in the last few months, you keep hearing in the newspaper around how real estate industry has really suffered and has slowed down. I think this is one budget where I think they've tried to provide at least some kind of trust in some form to the real estate industry, whether it's through relaxation of norms when it comes to or some of the tax incidents around debt investments into RE, or even around some of the developments around taxation of joint development agreements. Nishal, your perspective in terms of some of these changes and how it will probably affect the industry.
Sure. So I think primarily there have been three changes which impact the real estate sector. First is there was an exemption which was given for affordable housing. The SM has done is the affordable housing parameter was linked to 30 square meters of built-up area. So if the area is within 30 square meters, then in that situation the exemption was available. But 30 square meter was not sufficient to qualify, you know, as far as the metros are concerned, it was not working out. So SMS changed the concept of built-up area to carpet area, so that, you know, more projects can get covered within affordable housing for the purpose of seeking tax exemption. Second major change which impacts, you know, individuals, corporates, and all the owners, is that the holding period for the purpose of long-term capital gains has been reduced from 3 years to 2 years. So now if you are selling any flat or any land parcel or building, you know, within after 2 years, or even if it is before 3 years, you'll be tax rate of 20%, which otherwise was 30% for Indian basic. And there have been more revenues which are going to be announced by the finance minister as far as the type of assets in which you can invest to save your long-term capital gains. So earlier it was restricted to a couple of categories, now they're going to expand that. The third major change is on joint development agreements. Now, as per Section 45 of Income Tax Act, which deals with capital gains, the definition, the capital gains arise on transfer of a capital asset. The definition of transfer was broad enough to cover situations where, you know, the landowner gives part possession, gives possession of the land parcel to the developer for part or full performance of the contract. So even though actual transfer of land has not taken place, the mere handing over the possession to the developer for the construction development of the project was considered as transfer. So there was a lot of ambiguity on at what stage the landowner will be taxed, whether he will be taxed at the stage when the joint development agreement is signed, when the or when the possession is handed over to the developer, or when the actual possession of the flat along with the undivided parcel of land is handed over to the flat buyer. What the budget has done is, for individuals or Hindu undivided family, if they are owning some land parcel and entering into JDS, the budget specifically provides that the tax will get triggered only at the time of completion of the project. So the landowner can keep receiving the proceeds from the land parcel as long as the landowner is individual or HUF, and the taxation will happen only at the time of completion of the project. So this again is a major for the real estate industry, because this was always a tricky issue on at what stage the JDS will be taxable.
I just one point to add here, and that's an important change that has come in the real estate sector. You know, you mentioned about the reduction of holding period from 3 years to say 2 years. And as Finance Minister said, this is in order to create more liquidity, because you don't have to unnecessarily hold the apartment, so you create more supply. Okay, so on supply side, there has been, you know, but who is going to buy? Now, the next thing is that currently, if you held one immovable property and on that interest reduction was limited, maybe a lakh and a half or something like that, but if you held second property, then you get 100% reduction. This is a negative change. Now, look at, if I'm an investor, okay, and I buy another, okay, so for the investment purposes, right? Now, interest is not deductible. I do not have any more interest in purchasing second property. So there is always, there is a buyer and there is a seller. But by the time they both get together, you know, you need somebody to play a role to invest and hold it, because still the same buyer finds a seller and seller finds the right buyer, you know, there is that issue. So on the one hand, you are trying to create more liquidity, but you are taking financial liquidity out of the system. So this is a very negative change in my view. So investors may not have that much interest in buying an apartment or a house, which at some point in time they will let out.
Yeah.
But now, what happens if I buy if I buy an apartment, second apartment, so that some point in time, but it is not that I buy today and tomorrow I can let out.
Sure.
So it takes time depending on the market situation, but that is the function of investor. Okay, so investor has been negative in this sense.
Yeah.
So this was one implication I thought is negating the impact of reducing the holding period from 3 years to 2 years, but not allowing it to happen. That's why I said the last mile is always
visible. Yeah, and that's correct, Nishit. I think earlier, you know, the math was working out very well for the investors, because even if they, let's say they borrow loan from a bank to purchase a second apartment,
correct,
for investment purposes, that cost is today, if you take it, 9%, right? Now, if you are letting it out, the rental yields in India are 2%. So there is a gap of 7%, which will now have to be bridged through capital appreciation. Now, with demonetization and, you know, Real Estate Regulation Act and some of these laws coming in, it will become the demand and supply are going to be very difficult, you know, as they were, you know, before the demonetization and the implementation of RERA. So not only the rental yields are 2%, but even the capital appreciation is also going to go down. So earlier that on 9%, the investor was able to get a deduction for the entire interest paid, which means let's say 1/3, 33% if you take the tax rate. And you know, in the highest slab, typically the investment flats are purchased by the HNI, so will fall under the highest category. So the 9% becomes 6%. And the gap between 2 and 6%, it was not too difficult to bridge because of the capital appreciation. Now with no tax deduction available, and on top of that, the capital appreciation itself being a challenge, especially in metros, this is going to be a big hit for demand of real estate apartments going forward. So, you know, I think if the intent was to boost real estate sector post demonetization, this move is going to actually take us one step back.
Yeah. And the other areas which I do still think that will at least be useful for more, not just developers, but across the board, is at least on extension of some of the concessional rate of withholding tax in respect of rupee-denominated debt. So traditionally, if you look at debt investments which was coming into India, there were two or three different forms that it was taking. One was you had non-convertible debentures, which I think has been very prevalent in the real estate sector. Apart from now, non-convertible debentures, any interest coupon that is being paid out till 1st of July 2020 will enjoy a lower withholding tax rate. Similarly, in respect of masala bonds that are being issued, what they have essentially now provided is that so long as the bonds are issued prior to July 2020, they're going to enjoy a concessional rate of tax. So I think these are moves where I think the governments over the last 2-3 years have been saying that they want to increase the depth in the bond market. They want to have more kind of products. So all of this has sort of gone in towards that. Similarly, another exemption which they brought in was to say that if you're selling rupee-denominated bonds from one non-resident to another non-resident, that would be treated as an exempt transaction. The intent behind all of this is, as I said, it's purely to increase the depth of the market. But I think with this government, what we've sort of, or what this budget has really taught us is that what they give on one hand is something that they take away on the other hand. And which is precisely where that while they've given you all the incentives around low withholding tax around some of these bonds, but they've finally also introduced in capitalization rules, which sort of limit or restrict the deductibility when it comes to payments made to related parties. Mayban, to you, in terms of the thin cap rules, I don't think everyone was expecting it to come through, especially considering GAR was also in many ways looking at thin cap. But to you specifically on how the thin cap rules will now work.
Thanks, Rajesh. So the thin cap rules, what I'm going to do is just give a brief background on what thin cap rules are and like where does this concept come from, and what exactly are the parameters that have been sort of proposed in the Indian context, and what sectors that this is actually might potentially affect. So the thin cap rules are basically an idea that has been taken from the OECD BEPS multilateral sort of project that's been going on for a while. And the idea is that a lot of companies tend to borrow money to raise capital because it's cost of raising capital is much cheaper when you take a loan, and you also get the additional interest deduction when you are on an interest payment, which you don't get when you, if you have to pay dividends and if you have raised capital through the normal means. So the idea is that you're limiting the interest deduction because a lot of companies otherwise will have excessive leverage, or in comparison to the share capital that they hold, sometimes they have 3 to 4 times the debt payment that need to be made. So there are two ways in which this has been done globally. One, they usually mandate a debt to equity sort of ratio where they say that your debt cannot be more than 3 times or 4 times the equity that the company holds, because sometimes when the loan payments become very high, then the company doesn't have the equity to pay it, and then they default and companies are then default. So what has been done now in the Indian context is a different approach has been taken, where they have linked the the excess interest that can be deducted has been linked to the earnings made by the company in that particular year. So the cap that has been prescribed in the Indian context is effectively 30% of the earnings before interest, taxes and depreciation. So that is the maximum amount of interest that you can deduct in a year. And the problem with this is that, okay, so they have provided for a carry forward, in which case that if you make a loss in a particular year and you don't have the earnings to justify the deduction of the interest, and for that year you have a portion of your interest payments classified as excess interest and as non-deductible, you can carry it forward for 8 years. But again, even in future years, you need to have profits to justify the deduction of the interest. Now, this is going to affect the real estate sector more, because that's where you would generally see highly leveraged companies and lot of, where they take significant amount of loan. And the in addition to that, the other problems that come in this space is because of, in the Indian context, the term associated enterprise is very widely defined in the Income Tax Act. So potentially even a loan, somebody who's given a loan who's, this is more than 51% of the book value or even 10% of the total loan value will be considered an associated enterprise. Whereas traditionally speaking, associated enterprises are generally related party transactions or entities that you have common shareholders, you know, common people who are controlling the entities, etc. Here, I could be a third party bank and I've given, provided more than 10% of the loan that you own, and I could potentially be covered under this. So that's basically
So I think a couple of different points around this. One, the challenges which are really there, especially because in most situations, for example, on infra projects or even RE, there is always going to be project level debt that comes in. So what you end up doing is that you're going to have SPVs which are going to be there in place, which are actually going to raise raise funding or raise NCD from foreign portfolio investors. And those transactions now can potentially be caught within the thin cap net, which is usually a big problem, because if you think about it, what tends to happen is that these the SPI, the classic NCD model, where you're saying that, okay, I'm putting in debt at a project level SPV secured by the assets of the SPV. Especially, let's say pre-development or pre-commissioning, your coupon rate may be whatever, 15-18. If there's a refinancing, it probably comes down a little bit. But the moment now you're linking it to, you're saying that even in those circumstances, if the EBITDA of the company is not significant, there is a possibility that your complete interest deduction is not going to be available. That will generally be a matter for concern for most people, because the intent obviously was the fact that the government didn't want a situation where somebody put in 10 rupees of equity and 90 rupees of debt into their own SPV, so that instead of getting out interest dividend upstreaming, they take out the money as coupon payments. While the intent has been to capture that, but it is going to lead to a lot of situations where even with third parties, you're going to potentially have situations of the interest deduction being disallowed. Again, so while they've taken in principles from the international context in terms of the best action plan, because of the way that they've sort of defined associated enterprise or related parties, I think that will be a problem even as far as third party debt funding is concerned.
Just one point. I think the thin-cap norms are going to delay the launch of REITs and InvITs at least by 6 to 12 months, because all the structures which are being worked out for launching of REIT and InvIT are based on pushing down debt from the promoter entity. Now, the reason why the debt was being pushed down was to basically ensure that the profits earned by the SPV, which is holding the commercial property, are all upstreamed in the form of interest. And the way the structure was working out beautifully for the foreign investor was the withholding tax was only 5% on a pass-through basis, where, you know, the foreign investor would get credit in his own jurisdiction. So the structure actually for a foreign investor was complete pass-through right from the SPV level to the foreign investors level. What this will do is with the limit of 30% on interest, 30% of EBITDA, that's the maximum that can be deducted. The SPV will have to pay a lot of tax unless the developer or the sponsors are able to figure out a way to expense out the balance 70% of EBITDA. And as Rajesh and Maya mentioned, that because of the fact that the way the associated enterprise definition has been worded, a lot of third-party lending transactions could also get covered in the associated enterprise definition, which means even if I am paying interest to a genuine, a lender like a State Bank of India or, any other PSU bank, that if it is categorized as associated enterprise, then you are pretty much ending up paying all the tax. And that is one of the main reason why the REITs and InvITs have not been able to, take off, is because the yields are so low in India. It's 8% yield if you are getting, which is equivalent to the RBI bond rate, which is a risk-free rate of return. With this coming in, 8% can further fall to, based because of the 70% EBITDA, which will be taxable. And because of this issue, what is going to happen is we will see the delay in the launch of REITs and InvITs by at least 6 to 12 months, unless some clarification comes up.
Yeah, I think the only thing is that since this is technically at least applicable only on payment to non-residents, so I think the good bit is that for domestic structuring, while people will still do your thin cap structures, but I think the challenge will be now for foreign portfolio investors, or even if you are trying to raise project level funding, or even if the parent is putting an amount into the subsidiary.
See, I think the REITs and InvITs as a product makes sense more for international investors only, because for domestic investors, anyways, they are paying 30% tax. So they would rather invest in a fixed deposit, which is a risk-free product as compared to a REIT, because ultimately they are going to end up getting the same return from a fixed deposit versus a REIT. So these products were anyways more useful for international investors, and this particular amendment is targeted to international investors. So it will be interesting to see how.
In fact, what I see from your conversation is that, foreign investors will be impacted, less of Indian. But if you see in reality, majority of, say, 80% of investment comes from abroad.
Right.
Who has money in India? They are all borrowers by and large. And therefore, the thing is that, if you're looking to get foreign investment, this is dampener. So I think we need to have another round table here to discuss impact. There are a lot of bad news for real estate sector, if I may say so. But, not to be too generalized, it's important to understand these nuances, how it is going to impact the cash flows and stuff like this. So this is where
Yeah, and I think in some words, thin capitalization will have to be looked at along with the general anti-avoidance rules also, because general anti-avoidance rules are coming in place from 1st of April. The government actually very recently issued certain clarifications in the form of a Q&A in terms of, not really clarifying on when, in terms of safe harbors or when it will apply or not apply, but trying to give in a more generic responses, including a few things like can guard apply even when there's a specific anti-avoidance rule, the answer to that being yes, or in case of scheme of arrangements, will guard apply in those situations where the government sort of clarified that, well, the court has explicitly looked into the tax issues, they will not, but otherwise they have the power to. So essentially, what the government has also been trying to do is sort of put in the limits around what are the circumstances when guard will apply. I think the good bit that they have done is that the kind of checks and balances which they seem to have put in place, at least on paper, looks good. In the sense that there are going to be committee approvals, you're going to have retired high court judges who have to sign off in terms of application of guard. But obviously that's one, apart from all other concerns, that will always be what I would look at as a lingering concern that most investors would have until such time that you see how it actually works in practice. Just on the topic of anti-avoidance around indirect transfer or around the conversion issues. There have been quite a few anti-avoidance measures which have sort of been introduced in this budget. One of the things that they again have tried to sort of tinker with is in terms of the concept of income from other sources, which is essentially in respect of any transaction relating to receipt of shares or any assets at less than fair market value. So there have always been, traditionally, there have been provisions which have been there over the last 5 years in the Income Tax Act, which essentially provides that if a company which is not really a public company or a company in which the public are substantially interested essentially receives shares of another unlisted company, in that situation, if they have received it at less than fair market value, and fair market value for the government has been book value, in that case, the spread between the book value and the actual consideration paid would have been taxed in the hands of the recipient. In fact, there had been a lot of discussion or a lot of representation saying that this was really an anti-abuse provision, because at a practical level, we've seen a lot of situations where even genuine investors or startups have all been sort of put to a lot of litigation, a lot of scrutiny around it. With the tax authorities asking more and more questions, even though it's probably, let's say, a distressed sale or some other situation. So, in fact, there has been a lot of representation asking for more safe harbors around these kind of provisions. But instead, I think what the government has sort of gone about and taken the other extreme view to say that irrespective of what kind of company you are or what kind of entity you are, if you're receiving any assets for less than fair market value, in that case, the spread between the fair market value and the actual consideration paid will be brought within the tax net. Nishal, I think we've always had discussions around it in terms of the problems which private equity investors or VCs face. Your thoughts in terms of how this is probably going to impact
them? I think a couple of issues which are going to impact private equity investors. I think first is typically, you have call and put options with private equity investors, and sometimes, these are linked to default type of situations. So if there's a default by the local partner, then the private equity investors can either put their shares at a premium or at a discount, obviously subject to compliance with the FDI policy. But what happens in this situation, and this covers even domestic parties, not only international parties, is that if you have commercially negotiated something that, the shares will be either bought at a discount or sold at a premium, because of this provision where transactions have to take place at fair market value, the difference between the fair market value and the negotiated discounted price will be considered as, income for the transferor of the shares. So that's one major concern. Second is, in a lot of venture capital investment type of situations, the promoters usually get a re-up. So what re-up means is that depending on their performance, they can keep getting more and more shares in the company to increase their shareholding. Now, to achieve that re-up, the promoters are typically issued warrants at a very highly discounted price, and sometimes it's linked to the last round value, 30% or 40% discount to last round valuation. Now, in these type of situations, when they're getting this shares either from some other shareholder or from the company, there is this tax which could get triggered. So I think this particular provision is somewhere entering the territory of commercial contractual negotiation between the parties, which ideally government should not touch upon, because then you are infringing on the ability of two parties to commercially negotiate a transaction. So I think these two are major concerns which I see as far as private equity investors are concerned.
Yeah, and especially it's not only the fact that they made changes as far as the recipient is concerned. They've got, because essentially now you have a situation where the recipient is brought within the tax net in terms of receipt at less than fair market value, but they've also made changes on the transferor and Mansi, to you in terms of some of the changes that came through as far as the transferor is concerned.
Sure, absolutely. I think in addition, so what we've been talking, what Rajesh and Nishal had talked about was when you do these transfers below fair market value, they were the excess over the consideration to the fair market value, that spread they are going to tax in the hands of the recipient of these shares. At the same time, what this budget has introduced is now they will also tax that spread as part of the capital gain for the transferor. So essentially, they have basically provided that irrespective of what your consideration you paid for unlisted shares, they're going to look at the fair market value and use that to calculate the capital gains that the transferor makes. So essentially, I agree completely with Nishal. Both of these provisions are disregarding the fact that there could be commercial, justifiable commercial reasons for transferring shares at less than fair market value. They don't have any checks and balances in these provisions. Any transfers below fair market value can result in tax, both in the hands of the transferor and the transferee, and this result is definitely impacts the PEVC industry.
Sure. So I think one of the things as lawyers or accountants, all of us on PEVC deals have spent a lot of time over the last few years in terms of valuation on issue, valuation concerns over issuance of shares, over transfer of or receipt of shares. Now we also have to add in one more to the list in respect of transfer of shares. I think the last point before I sort of open it up for the audience is, we've talked a lot about tax for the day, but apart from tax, there's also been a lot of policy changes. Some of them are actually big announcements being made in terms of FIPB being abolished. Michelle, in terms of how that's probably going to have an impact as well as the investment side.
Sure. So I think it's a great move towards ease of doing business. I think there are a couple of issues which the investors were facing with respect to FIPB. One was it delayed the timeline for consummating the transaction. And as you know, right now there is a huge rush from various international investors to close their transactions before 31st of March 2017 because their treaty benefits are going away. Now, we are stuck with a situation where, you know, even though the transaction documents have been signed, the approval is lying with FIPB. And we are at the mercy of FIPB as to when they will revert, right? And it might happen that just because of FIPB, the transaction could get delayed beyond 1st of April 2017, in which case, when that investor sells the shares for their income, they will not get the treaty benefits. So timeline is a major concern as far as FIPB is concerned. Second was FIPB has always been asking from a KYC perspective about the confidential details about the limited partners of the offshore fund, which in certain situations has been very difficult for the general partners to share that information, given the fact that when they sign the fund documents with the limited partners or investors, there's a confidentiality obligation which they sign up with the limited partners. So these two issues have been causing a lot of concerns for the international investors. I don't think the abolition of FIPB is going to solve the second problem, which is to share the information, KYC and other things, because that's something any country would require from any international investor. But hopefully the 6 to 8 week timeline for getting the FIPB approval, hopefully that will be taken away. Of course, the finance minister has said that the roadmap would be announced soon, and we hope that, you know, there is something which is done to ensure that the investors don't have to wait for 6 to 8 weeks to get their approval. I think the reason why the FM announced the abolition of FIPB, there are two or three reasons. One is, almost 90% of sectors in India are now open to 100 to investment under automatic route to the extent of 100%. Now, when FIPB was set up in early 90s, this was not the case. You know, we had just opened our economy to foreign investment and most of the sectors were subject to government approval. So it made a lot of sense to have FIPB at that time. And FIPB also over a period of time has been shifted to Department of Industrial Policy and Promotion. Then it was shifted under Department of Economic Affairs. And now time has come where, you know, just for few sectors, you don't need a body like FIPB, which is considered to be a roadblock for ease of doing business for foreign investors in India. So two or three things. So one is more than 90% sectors are an automatic route. Second, which the government has observed, is that most of the sectoral laws have the requirement for the investor to take sectoral regulator's approval. So it was also resulting in duplication. Because on one hand, let's say if you have to invest in insurance company, as an investor, you have to approach IRDA for getting the approval. There was no point in going back to FIPB to, you know, basically IRDA looks at the same thing which FIPB will broadly look at on the credibility of the investor, source of fund, jurisdiction and all those things. So it was resulting in duplication of timeline, duplication of effort, duplication on collation of information. So it was not making sense to have FIPP from that perspective. Second was, if you see today the way FEMA is administered, there are three bodies which are looking at it. One is DIPP, which is Department of Industrial Policy and Promotion, which formulates the FDI policy. Then you have FIPP, which administers the FDI policy. And then you have Reserve Bank of India, which is ultimately overall looking at the monetary policy and compliance with FEMA. For as far as foreign investment is concerned. So there is no need of three bodies to more or less look at the compliance of, you know, the exchange control regulations in India. In fact, in one of the recent situations when, you know, the foreign investment in pharma sector was allowed from 49% to 74%, one of our clients was acquiring between 49 to 74%. We had applied to FIPB. And before FIPB considered the application, there was a circular which came out that now 49 to 74% are under automatic rule. So, you know, we withdrew the application. And then what happened was the authorized dealer said that till the time Reserve Bank of India notifies this in the form of master circular, we are not going to allow you to transfer under automatic rule. So much of bureaucracy, one body is allowing you, second body is not allowing you for the same thing. And that's where, you know, it was resulting in multiplicity of regulators and, you know, it makes a lot of sense to abolish FIPB. Obviously, we'll have to see whether they replace FIPB with some other body. I think that will be, again, the, the same problem. But broadly, I think this is a positive step. Second important step is the security receipts issued by the Asset Reconstruction Trust. Government is allowing the security receipts to be listed to increase the liquidity. And today the big focus, thanks to the former RBI Governor Raghuram Rajan, has been to clean up the non-performing assets of the bank. And asset reconstruction companies are a major source for cleaning up some of these non-performing assets because they buy these NPAs from the banks. Now, the listing of SRs is going to increase the liquidity, but, you know, these are not going to be heavily traded securities. So, I'm not sure the benefit of this is going to be derived immediately. It will take some time. But more important than that is the category of investors who can invest in security receipts, which currently is restricted only to qualified institutional buyers. So only sophisticated investors can invest. But if they can expand the number of investors who can invest in security receipts, I think that would have been a much better way to liberalize this particular sector. Especially in wake of demonetization also, a lot of people are saying that, you know, the SMEs have been impacted, and these SMEs are going to default in near future. So there are going to be more NPAs which are going to be generated in the next 6 to 12 months because of the bankruptcy or, you know, the SME is not functioning properly. So I think this is one positive step, but obviously we'll have to see how much advantages is it. I think one disappointment from the budget from a regulatory perspective has been that in the last budget, the FM had announced that he is looking at allowing optionally convertible instruments to be issued to non-resident investors under FDI policy, under automatic rules. Now, given the plethora of laws which India has, you know, so many regulations the foreign investors have to comply with, the optionally convertible instrument would have been a great way to send signal to the foreign investor that we are liberalizing the foreign investment regime further. From a sectoral perspective, FM has done a, you know, this government has done a great job in liberalizing almost all sectors in the last 2 years. But from an instrument perspective, I think this was something that was needed because of the complexity of the deal making in India, given the laws that we have. So this is one thing which, you know, could have been announced by the finance minister and which would have brought cheers from international investors. But this is something which has been missed out.
Sure. So I think on a macro level, obviously, I think one of the things, and we've seen this in the past also, where announcements have been made, but there is a delay in terms of it being implemented. Hopefully, the optionally convertible instruments will sort of come through. So while we haven't had the time to discuss on some of the other provisions, whether it's in relation to non-payment of STT or for securities after 2004, where you don't get cap gains exemption, except for cowards that they'll introduce, or even on the poem. But I think considering the time limit involved, I think this is probably a good time to sort of end and take questions. But before that, Nishit, last words.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I started by saying that directionally it is a good budget, but it provides a roadmap that is circuitous and unending. Therefore, the job of finance minister, I would say finance minister did a good job because his job is to give direction. But the administration has done a little poor job because it does not take it to its logical conclusion. And that will be my first comment. Number two is that a lot of discretion, as I said, are being given to the junior officers, and that is where the concern is. Now, two problems arise. I've talked in, say, favor of the taxpayer. But the difficulty and more difficulty is for tax administration as well, because with the GAR coming in, if they do not take any action, they will be hauled up, maybe after retirement or who knows, like it happened to IDBI or whatever it is, right? It is not unusual nowadays to pick up people after the retirement that you did something wrong while you were there. So one problem, and a major problem for the bureaucrat, is to be fair and justicious, is that they operate under the fear of unknown, that if they take a good faith decision in favor of a taxpayer, if they do not raise GAR issue, what's going to happen? Some point in time, he'll be hauled up, hey, why did you not raise the GAR issue? Because GAR is so subjective, and that could cause a problem. Now, therefore, more likely than not, there'll be a lot of GAR issues. There are protections and the shields provided, but how is the shield available? Tax officer might raise an issue, then you have to go to principal commissioner maybe, and then you go to the panel on GAR. So you've got whole route to go on. I do not know how long it is going to take and when I'll come to know whether my structure was right or wrong or what's there, you know. So the difficulty is that you have created a system where you all of the tax officials, if they make a good faith decision, I think we'll have to really work around that to more and more. So this is one major concern, that we'll have more litigious situation going forward. Okay, third point I mentioned already about the real estate sector, it's a dampener. I think it needs to be re-looked at, otherwise you are further going downward, the real estate sector. And there have been a couple of good provisions on the whole, corporate reduction taxes and stuff like that. But barring that, on the whole, like it's a reverse coconut syndrome, like you're soft outside and hard inside. And it does not take you, as I say, the land where it is intended to go. So once again, we must compliment Finance Minister for giving good direction, but hope administration will quickly take note of this and make necessary corrections so we move on a fast-forward path, which is required at this point in time in light of the U.S. and the Brexit and the other changes that have happened around the world. With those words, I can say thank you so much.
And we open to questions. I think
most welcome. Thank
and
you.
I think if you can first take questions from the...
there are people on the phone, maybe. Thank you very much for staying so long. If there are any questions over phone, most welcome.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone wishing to ask a question may please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Participants, in order to ask a question, you may please press star and one. A reminder to the participants, anyone wishing to ask a question, may please press star and one.
Yeah. Okay, there appears to be no question. So anybody in the auditorium here?
My question is to Mr. Nischal. So as you...
your name and...
My name is Raj Shah and I'm from Diya Doshin's company, Chartered Accountants.
Okay.
So this is regarding to real estate sector. As you mentioned, the current scenario is that the real estate property yields rental income of around 2-3% and the loan rates are around 9%. So my question is, due to demonetization, there is a large chunk of funds that has come to organized sector, and due to cashless drive that is going in our country, can we expect that this gap of 9% that the top line will reduce as we go forward gradually?
So I think clearly a lot will depend on how much the government has been able to collect or will be able to collect in terms of taxes, and you know, the cash deposits, how much are genuine, how much are not genuine, because that will impact the balance sheet of the government and the Reserve Bank of India. So the rate cut will depend on that, whether the 9% reduces to 8.5% or 8%, will depend on how much cash the government is settled with or the banks are settled with. As far as the 2% is concerned, that will depend on the demand supply, because clearly with this issue, the HNI is considering real estate as an investment, as an asset class. You know, there is definitely going to be a relook at this investment class, given the fact that the returns won't be as lucrative as they were before. Now, if that is the situation, then that could also impact the rental market, correct? Because you will see more deals which are for consumption, rather self-consumption, rather than for, you know, investment and then renting out. So I think this issue is going to remain for some time till we are able to get over this demonetization issue for the real estate sector.
So I'm Agam Javeri from Riyad Vision Company Chartered Accountants. I also have a question for you regarding the rental income. So what you said is that the interest amount on LOP has been reduced by the government, or the deduction allowed. Mm. So is the government trying to not promote purchase of multiple properties by few HNIs, like not concentration of too much properties in the hands of few?
So that, I mean, that could be one reason. Second is obviously a lot of people are using it to reduce their taxes.
Yes.
You know, this thing. And I think the third is, and related to the first reason, that government may not want the speculation in the real estate prices. Now, if one HNI is purchasing, let's say, 20 flats out of 50 flats in a building, then there is a lot of possibility of speculation, right? And that also somewhere was also resulting in generation of black money and all those things. So I think this move is to disincentivize them to enter into such transactions. One is cash transactions. And second is, if it is not lucrative, then anyways, you know, the speculation will also stop because they're not going to do that. They may shift to some other asset classes like gold or shares or, you know, stock markets. But at least as far as real estate is concerned, this might be. And this will also bring the prices down in the market, which is what the ultimate aim of the government is, that the housing has to be affordable for everybody. Now, this typically the HNIs who are into investment business, they, because for them, you know, there is no, they are using this as an investment mode. The prices are jacked up because of that. The moment there is no demand from the HNIs for investment purposes, the developers will also reduce the price and make it more affordable for self-consumption.
I have another perspective on this whole thing. You know, we are assuming that there are investors sitting on the sidelines, right? And there are individual investors. That's your mindset, because that's it. Actually, this will also apply to institutional investors. So, and traditionally, globally, what happens is that when you have a company buying number of apartments, okay, so that they can rent out in a systematic way. Now, again, this may impact them as well, you know. And organized development of real estate, you know, is something that will be negatively impacted. I personally feel that, you know, really speaking, India is not that rich. There are hundreds of all the buildings are owned. How many buildings are fully owned by one individual and rent out in a systematic manner? Very few. You typically will find somebody has 2-3 apartments here and one rental here and one rental there. That's how it has gone in. But what we need to develop is organized rental system for housing as well. Now, what's going to happen to those kind of things? So, first of all, I think that the idea of not allowing interest on the second property in particular, okay, is a bad idea. You know, because as we said, then what is my incentive? I get 2% rental. That also I have to find buyer, or you know. And number two, on the top of it, I'm therefore making losses all the time. And if, you know, in real world, I'm paying 9%. Initially generous, okay. He's very generous, I think. How many times you go in the market and get finance at 9%, you pay 15%, 16%, sometimes 20, depending, you know, and you get rental of 2% or maybe less sometimes, and empty property for a long period of time. So, you know, it's complete dampener, you know. This is something which really needs to be addressed quickly. If on the one hand you want to increase liquidity, when liquidity increase is assumed, obviously prices go down, okay, but the interest rates still continue to be where they are. There has not been that significant, especially for non-corporate sector, and corporate sector doesn't have, you know, finance. So, this is I think, something that of a concern. And India is a large country, okay? So we want to have development of real estate in all different parts of India, you know. And we don't go outside the metros like Mumbai and others. The systems are so inefficient, so the cost of inefficiency that exists in India is adding up to number of the, you know, travel, maintenance, all those kind of things, you know, it really creates a lot of problems. So anyway, this is my perspective.
Yeah, and also, I think this is more on the demand side from HNI, but even on the supply side, just like I mentioned about thin capitalization, now a lot of developers in India are funded through debt from foreign investors. Now, if you keep that here, one is for REIT or, you know, even for infra companies, a lot of this funding has come from foreign investors. Now, if that interest is going to be disallowed, which means the cost of construction of the project automatically increases. Now, when the cost of construction increases, the incentive for the developer, he will obviously jack up the price to that extent, he's not going to incur a loss. But at the same time, there are no buyers even for the current price. So when he's increasing the price, obviously, you know, the number of buyers are going to further reduce. So I think we will see substantial reduction in the number of deals which will happen in the real estate space, at least again, as I mentioned, 6 to 12 months, especially for projects which have been funded through foreign debt. Local debt is not that much. So if there is an ECB which is borrowed for infrastructure, or there is a private equity investor, real estate fund type of investor which has put in foreign fund into Indian real estate project, all these issues are going to come up. Obviously, if it is a local PSU bank which is lent from India and not through, you know, not ECB, through offshore branches and other things, there, you know, you will still continue to get the deduction, because I think this thin cap is applicable only for debt issued to a foreign resident, not to local banks. So even if local banks get caught under the associated enterprises definition, they will still be okay, because it's not supposed to catch that. But foreign debt funded entities are going to face a problem.
So now just look at one more, because this real estate, suddenly I also realized, I did not realize when I read the budget, but as I think more, and as like global investors, suppose I am having a finance, right? Is it worth my putting money in India? Or I better put it abroad, where I can get lower rate of bank interest? My property is better managed. If tenant doesn't vacate, that risk is also much better here. I rent out of so many properties, one person doesn't vacate, I can't even sell, I can have the whole of my profit. So does it really make sense for me to invest in India at all? Another thing, that because Trump has really put a lot of focus on infrastructure, because America is again developing country now, what he thought it would develop. Its infrastructure has gone very bit here, maybe he will be able to tell it more. But America needs to be rebuilding itself. So the legal system, the financial system, a lot of things are at least predictable, you know, and therefore it is easier for me to put money in infra bond in the US, okay, and I'm more assured there is no capital gains and of the foreign investors, except of course the US is different, but otherwise there is no I'm better off putting money in the US than in India. And with so much incentives going up in the US, okay, and other thing is, US is also allowing, if you put $1.5 million in the real estate in the US, I can take hold my family as a green card holder. Okay, EB-5 is the most popular visa, which allows you to take hold family of four. It is currently $500,000, it's going up to $1.5 million, but $1.5 million for Indians is not, at least high net. So I'm just mentioning that UK, properties have come down. So what is my incentive? I put money in Mayfair rather than Mumbai. Okay, very simple is that.
And also I think if you see the corporate bond market in India, I think government has taken very good steps in the last 8 years, 8 to 9 years, to give further flip to the corporate bond market in India, especially most of these bonds are invested by foreign investors. Now, with this one amendment on thin capitalization, the entire effort of the last 8 to 9 years might just go in vain, because it will no longer remain attractive.
So they need to make REITs more attractive for foreign investors. Right.
Yeah, but you know, the what has been provided today doesn't encourage. It's a little unfortunate.
See, REITs,
at a top level, we see great directional perspective, great ideas. Everything on the top looks very good, but somebody pulls plug by putting one condition here, one condition there, and it's a non-starter then, you know.
See, also internationally, most of the countries, the thin capitalization norms are linked to debt equity ratio more than the EBITDA. Now, this is more like, if you recollect, you know, a few years back, government had introduced this concept of 2% MAT on gross assets of the company. Right, which had no link with the profits made by the company. This is more or less similar to that which government withdrew after a lot of industry representations and UN cry. This is a similar issue. You are linking something with an unrelated parameter, which means the idea of incorporating the concept of thin cap is to ensure that government collects more taxes. That should not ideally be the idea. The idea should be that your debt equity has to be in a proportion which is decent enough to, you know, ensure that, you know, you are not misusing the tax structure. So even if it was, let's say, 4:1 or 3:1, then in infra and real estate, 4, 5, 6 to 1 is a very standard debt equity ratio. Now, as far as that was, if it was introduced in that form, it should have still been okay, because then, you know, I wouldn't have been required to restrict it to 30% of EBITDA. I am meeting with the requirement of 3:1, 4:1. But allow me to take benefit of the interest till whatever EBITDA I want to. You can't stop me from using that. It's a legitimate instrument which the government has acknowledged.
So that's interesting, and I think one other point on real estate is the largest employer. Now their projects, if they are stopped halfway, which has already begun to happen, are we going to generate more employment or not? I think that's the question I'll leave it to you to reply. But those are some concerns, and I hope we are all very happy overall that we are doing. But let's see, wrinkles are clear now. Thank you very much for the great job you have done this morning, and this will be all telecast on our mission.tv as well. So please do.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.